You are listening to This Week in Palestine, Truth and Justice Radio, WZBC, Boston College. Today is Sunday, August 2nd, 2026. Before we step into this hour, a clear reminder for every listener joining us now. The perspectives you hear today belong solely to our hosts and guests. They rise from their lived experience, their research, and their commitment to speaking truth without hesitation. They do not represent the official views of WZBC, Boston College, or its Board of Trustees. In this space, nothing is softened, nothing is filtered, nothing is shaped to satisfy institutions or protect comfort. What you hear belongs to the people who speak it, fully, directly, and without apology. And with that clarity set firmly before us, we begin. This Week in Palestine is not a place where truth hesitates. It does not knock politely or wait for permission to enter. Here, truth steps forward with its spine straight, its voice unshaken, and its presence impossible to ignore. Urgency is not decoration in this space. It is the pulse behind every sentence, every report, every breath taken at this microphone. Clarity is not optional. It is the obligation we accept the moment we speak. And while our heart beats in Palestine, in the alleys of Jerusalem, in the camps of the West Bank, in the shattered streets of Gaza, our vision reaches far beyond the borders carved by occupation or diplomacy. Because the forces shaping Palestinian life do not stop at checkpoints or concrete walls. They move through parliaments, through corporate boardrooms, through the quiet corridors where powerful hands make decisions that ordinary people must live with. Wherever you are listening now, driving through the long hours of your shift, lifting your first cup of coffee into the morning light, or sitting in the stillness of your home, thank you for choosing to be here. I am your host and narrator, Arlene Russell. In this space, we do not file down the edges of truth to make it easier to swallow. We do not bend the story to comfort those who prefer silence. We do not dilute reality for anyone's convenience. Here, truth stands unfiltered. Resistance is not theory. It is breath. It is survival. Solidarity is not a slogan. It is a lineage carried from one generation to the next. The voices rising from occupied land do not tremble. They rise beside movements across the world demanding dignity, justice, and liberation. They remind us that struggle is never isolated. It is woven across borders, across histories, across the lives of people who refuse to surrender their humanity. This hour is not simply a broadcast. It is a lifeline, a thread stretching from Palestine to every corner of the globe, binding devastation to determination, binding grief to a future still worth reaching for. Even in the deepest darkness, the spark of defiance survives. Even when the world turns away, that spark refuses to die. Each week, we bring you reporting that cuts through distortion, analysis that refuses disguise, and reflections that center Palestinian life in all its depth, complexity, and unbroken courage. We speak with intention because the stakes demand nothing less. This Week in Palestine is not a refuge for polite silence. It is testimony. It is urgency. It is solidarity without hesitation. The struggle for freedom is shared. It crosses borders, and it remains sacred. Today, we confront a claim that shakes the foundations of modern political discourse, a claim made by an Israeli scholar who argues that one of history's greatest tragedies has been transformed into a political shield, a shield used not to protect the memory of victims, but to justify violence against another people. This is not an easy conversation. It is not comfortable. It is not meant to be.
This is a clear discussion between Owen Jones, a British journalist and political commentator known for confronting power structures and exposing state-sanctioned injustice, and his guest, Omer Bartov, an Israeli-American historian specializing in genocide studies and the manipulation of collective memory. Even though I believe that Omer Bartov takes the side of Israel, this discussion is very important because it reveals the Palestinian situation and their struggle against Israeli political narratives. Let's try to understand how a historical trauma became a political instrument. The Holocaust stands as one of humanity's darkest chapters. Millions murdered, families erased, communities destroyed. The world vowed never again to genocide, never again to dehumanization, never again to silence in the face of mass suffering. But today, some scholars argue that this vow has been twisted, that never again has been weaponized into never question, that the memory of Jewish suffering has been used to shield a state from accountability, even when its actions mirror the very horrors the world promised to prevent. Now, let's see how this transformation happened. In the decades following World War II, Israel positioned itself as the inheritor of Jewish trauma. The state became synonymous with Jewish identity, Jewish survival, and Jewish memory. Any criticism of Israeli policy was framed as an attack on Jewish existence itself. The Holocaust became not only a historical event, but a political tool, a tool used to silence dissent, deflect scrutiny, and delegitimize anyone who spoke about Palestinian suffering. According to the scholar at the center of this discussion, this weaponization did not happen overnight. It evolved through education systems, diplomatic strategies, media narratives, and global alliances. It evolved through the insistence that Israel must always be seen as a victim, even when it holds overwhelming military power. It evolved through the idea that Jewish trauma is eternal, while Palestinian trauma is negotiable, dismissible, or invisible. Let's try to understand the consequences of this narrative. When Palestinian homes are demolished, the world is told it is security. When Palestinian children are killed, the world is told it is self-defense. When entire neighborhoods are flattened, the world is told it is necessary. And when anyone questions these explanations, they are accused of hatred, extremism, or denial of Jewish suffering. The Holocaust becomes a rhetorical shield, raised not to honor the dead, but to silence the living. Today, we examine how this shield has shaped global politics. Governments hesitate to condemn Israeli actions because they fear being labeled anti-Semitic. Media outlets soften language to avoid backlash. Universities punish students who speak about Palestinian rights. Human rights organizations are attacked for documenting violations. The scholar argues that this climate of fear is not accidental. It is engineered. It is maintained. It is enforced. Let's see what this enforcement looks like. A journalist publishes evidence of war crimes. Their career is threatened. A professor teaches about settler colonialism. Their contract is not renewed. A student group organizes a protest. Their funding is revoked. A survivor of violence speaks publicly. Their testimony is dismissed as propaganda. The Holocaust becomes a political firewall, blocking accountability and protecting power. But today, we confront a different truth. The scholar insists that honoring the Holocaust means preventing all genocide, not just the genocide of one people. Honoring the Holocaust means recognizing the humanity of all victims, not only those whose suffering fits political narratives. Honoring the Holocaust means refusing to allow its memory to justify new cycles of violence. Now, let's try to understand the heart of this argument. The scholar is not denying the Holocaust. He is not diminishing Jewish suffering. He is not attacking Jewish identity. He is confronting the way trauma has been manipulated to justify oppression. He is confronting the way history has been turned into a weapon. he's confronting the way never again has been selectively applied. Today, we step into this uncomfortable space. Today, we examine the claim that the Holocaust has been weaponized. Today, we ask what happens when memory becomes a political tool. Today, we ask what happens when trauma becomes a shield for violence. Today, we ask what happens when truth becomes dangerous. Let's see where this leads. Let's try to understand what this scholar is revealing. Let's listen carefully, because the implications reach far beyond Israel and Palestine. They reach into the very question of how societies remember, how they justify, and how they repeat the tragedies they claim to oppose. This is the battle over free speech. This is the battle over historical memory. This is the battle over truth. And today, we confront it head on. Ready for this? Let's listen together.
I've been teaching classes on genocide for a quarter of a century. I can recognize one when I see one. Those were the words written by Professor Omer Bartov. He's an Israeli-American Dean's Professor of Holocaust and Genocide Studies at Brown University, one of the world's preeminent, really, experts on the Holocaust and genocide. Now, I've interviewed Omer a few times now since the genocide began. In fact, way back in 2023, not long after it began. Now, he's written this new book called Israel, What Went Wrong, which has caused, I'd say, a lively debate and some controversy, I think partly because maybe of the title, which I think maybe led to a slightly misleading impression from some. I think it's caused some frustration from Bartov, who think maybe people read the title and didn't read the book. But I have, so that helps. Firstly, really great to see you, Omer. I know you're currently in sunny Madeira, so thanks for joining us. How are you doing?
Thanks for having me. Yeah, I'm great. Thanks.
So, just going to start. So, this book, so really fascinating book. And as I've said, you know, you're one of the great scholars on genocide, on the Holocaust. And when you wrote, when you publicly spoke about this being a genocide, like so many of your colleagues, not least other scholars from Israel who specialize in genocide, who spoke about this being a genocide, very, very important moments during just accepting or gaining public recognition of the facts of what was taking place. So let's just start. I'm just going to start with the beginning. Now, a Palestinian might respond that nothing, might respond saying this was a settler colonial movement seeking to establish a Jewish majority state in overwhelmingly Palestinian land. And that would always, in any trajectory, inevitably produce dispossession, ethnic cleansing, and domination. Were they to say that, were they to say that's just the inevitable trajectory, there wouldn't have been any other possible trajectory, would they be wrong?
No, I mean, as I write in the book, they'd be partly right, but it just doesn't tell the whole story. From the point of view of Palestinians, of course, for Palestinians, Zionism was a settler colonial movement. Palestinians were living in Palestine, before it was called Palestine as well. And Zionist Jews came there, unlike previous communities of Jews who either lived there or came there. Zionist Jews came there to make it or part of it into a Jewish national state. And that meant dispossession, and it entailed obvious violence. So from the point of view of Palestinians, that's what Zionism was. From the point of view of Jews coming from Europe, it didn't look like that. And I'm a historian, so I look at things from various perspectives, not only one side's perspective. And from that point of view, things look somewhat different. And the sort of example that I have used for that is that my own grandparents, both of whom were Orthodox Jews, came to Palestine in the 1920s and 1930s. And they're the reason that I was born in Israel in the 1950s. Had they not come in the 1920s and 1930s, as did most of their families, I would not have been born, because all my family on my father's and mother's side were murdered in Poland. Now, does that justify Zionist settler colonialism? No. But history is not a sort of a game in looking back and saying things had to happen. What happened had to happen. I don't believe in predetermined history. And so I think that, as I write in the book, in the 1920s and 30s in particular, Zionism has two faces, and it's difficult to keep those two perspectives in one head, but they did exist. One was that Zionism did provide the safe haven for hundreds of thousands of Jews who came there, and had they not come there, and they had very few other places to go to, Britain was not too happy accepting Jews at that point. The U.S. had closed its gates to immigration. Had they not come there, they would probably have been murdered. At the same time, those Jews who came, including my grandparents, functionally became, from the point of view of Palestinians, settler colonial individuals who were taking over land. I think if you want to understand the story, you have to tell the whole thing. And if you want to understand what Zionism was and how it saw itself as a national movement. Now, it was an ethno-national movement, and in fact, it triggered the creation of another ethno-national movement, which is Palestinian nationalism. But as an ethno-national movement, it had, of course, also, as all ethno-national movements do, a strong violent potential. And that potential has come, of course, today to a kind of particularly horrific climax. But that was what Jews created for themselves in Europe when they were confronted with other ethno-national movements that wanted to exclude them, persecute them, and kick them out, and eventually, of course, participated in murdering them. So that's the more complex picture of that. And when I say what went wrong, I really try to understand how these two faces of Zionism became increasingly one face. And that face is the face of exclusion, of violence, of militarism, of ethnic cleansing, and eventually of genocide.
I suppose some might argue that, because you talk about these two faces, obviously this idea that on one side it was felt as a lived experience, Jewish liberation, on the other hand, obviously for Palestinians, a settler colonialism. But could that liberatory face have ever succeeded without the dispossession required by the other? There's no, it's, you know, because you say one triumphed over the other, but how could that sense of this is going to be a liberation movement for Jewish people in the land of Palestine, where obviously back in 1917, 95% or so were Arab Muslims or Christians, how could it be possible for that liberatory phase to succeed without the dispossession required by the other?
So for the one thing, there were people who were talking about that during the 1920s and 30s, and there were voices within the Zionist movement itself that were talking about, can we find a recipe for coexistence between Jews and Palestinians? In fact, if you look at the history, say, of the Zionist left, and much of it was socialist at the time, HaShomer HaTzair, which was the youth movement of the more left-wing Marxist faction of Zionist socialism, believed in a binational state. My own parents, who ended up fighting in the war of 1948, believed in a binational state. There were people like Martin Buber and others from Brit Shalom, from the Alliance of Peace, who spoke about creating some kind of coexistence, either two states or binational state or some kind of formula that would enable Jews and Palestinians to share the space. Now, it doesn't mean that they did not think that they belonged there. They did. This was a fundamental assumption by Zionists and, mind you, by many religious Jews. Again, I mean, if I refer to my grandparents, when they came to Palestine, they thought that they came home. They could not think of themselves as colonizing a place. They were religious Jews, and they thought that the land of Israel was their place. But there were many people in the 20s and 30s, diminishing numbers, who thought that the only way for Zionism to succeed without becoming what it has become, and warned about it, including Hannah Arendt, by the way, was to find a way for Jews and Palestinians to live together. Tom Segev, many years ago, you know, the Israeli historian and journalist, wrote a book, Palestine One Complete, it's called in the English. I wrote about it maybe 20 years ago for the New York Times. And in that book, he tries to identify the moment during the British Mandate in which that option of Jewish-Arab coexistence disappeared. And the different people who have different ideas. Was it in 1929 with the killings in Hebron and then in Jerusalem and Jaffa? Was it in 1936 with the Arab uprising? But that was not inevitable. And generally, look, I mean, this whole argument that everything was inevitable, is ahistorical. There was a book by A.J.P. Taylor many years ago, From Luther to Hitler, which argued that, you know, once Luther came to the scene, Hitler was inevitable. That's not history, that's ideology. And I think that there were options that were being discussed. Now, these were mostly removed in 1948. The idea of Jewish-Palestinian coexistence disappeared in 1948, and that's why 1948 is such an important moment. But before that, I think there was a great deal of discussion of that, including, of course, other people such as Ben-Gurion, who did hope to find some way of transferring the Palestinians. And many people refer to his infamous letter to his son, where he's very happy that the British propose that idea of transfer in the Peel Commission report in 1937, because that legitimizes it then for people like Ben-Gurion to say, well, maybe that's a good idea.
Pre-1948, let's just talk about that in terms of why some might say, well, actually, this was inevitable. Because you're right, nothing in history is inevitable, but you can look at an ideology and say with perhaps some degree of not total certainty, but with a strong sense of this is a very likely kind of trajectory of this ideology based on what it is prescribing in this environment. And I think you can discuss that. In 1921, the Zionist leader, Vladimir Jabotinsky, he said, he challenged the idea, he wrote this book in The Iron Wall, that Palestinian opposition could be overcome through economic development or persuasion. He said they're a native population, they're responding rationally as a native population would under the conditions of feeling colonized, essentially. And he said that Zionist colonization would have to proceed in defiance of the will of the native population, protected by an external force they couldn't defeat. And at the same time, you had labor Zionism, which had this basically approach of conquest of labor. You seek to replace Palestinian workers with Jewish workers, and therefore you create a self-sufficient Jewish economy. And they work to remove Arab workers from the Jewish economic sector, whilst land acquisition settlement frequently displaced Palestinian cultivators. Ben-Gurion, you mentioned him. He said, I support compulsory transfer. I do not see anything immoral of it. He said that in 1938. You look at those examples and you kind of think to yourself, pre-1938, that's Ben-Gurion. He's the founding prime minister of Israel. You look at what Labour Zionism is promoting, and these are often people who call themselves socialists, as you say. You look at what Vladimir Jabotinsky said, seems very difficult to dispute, and that is what happened. Those three pieces of evidence seems to suggest this is just how Zionism would inevitably pre-1948 evolve.
Hey, look, I mean, let me say first, you can think of an interesting moment just after these dates that you mentioned. On the 29th of November, 1947, because on the 29th of November, 1947, the British, having said that they're going to abandon the mandate, they're fed up with that place and they're leaving, the UN comes up with, the newly established United Nations comes up with a plan, a partition plan. And it actually suggest the creation of two states, an Arab state and a Jewish state. Now, the leadership of the Palestinians and the surrounding Arab countries reject it. And they have good reasons for rejecting it. They say, look, it's unfair. The Jews are only a third of the population of Palestine, and they're being given over half of the territory. And that would also have meant the creation of a Jewish state, which would have had a vast Arab minority, almost half. But there was an option to create two states. And the Zionist leadership accepts that partition. Now, I think that historically, if you look back, you could say that it was a mistake not to accept the partition resolution by the leadership of the Palestinians, because then there would have been two states. And the Jewish state would have been just over 50% of the territory. So in that sense, all this inevitability that we're talking about, actually, it could have worked out differently. And it was a political decision in 1947, which, as I say, had good reasons, but I think historically, in retrospect, was a mistake. There could have been two states, and the leadership of the Zionists actually agreed to that. Now, going back to Jabotinsky wrote that famous article, The Iron War, in the late 1920s. That article is a very interesting article. Jabotinsky, in general, is actually a very interesting character. He was also a translator, an author, a novelist, very different from the kind of people who took over that party now, who are anything but that. But what he writes in The Iron War, what he basically argues is that, and he's right in that sense, that if you want to create a Jewish state within the Middle East, that state will be opposed by the Palestinians and by other Arab states. He doesn't speak just about the Arab population in Palestine. And he says, we have to make our presence there inevitable. The people will accept that we are there. And for that, we have to build what he calls an iron wall. Until they accept our existence there, and then we can normalize relations with them. Ironically, of course, that's what Israel succeeded in doing, but did not accept. So if you think, in 2002, Saudi Arabia offered peace with Israel to normalize Israel's relations with the rest of the Arab world on condition that it normalize its relations with the Palestinians. And Israel has since then totally ignored that offer by Saudi Arabia. But that was exactly the moment that Jabotinsky spoke about. That is, that Israel's neighbors had actually accepted it as a political entity there, but Israel would not accept that because he wanted the land without the people in it. It wanted the land without the Palestinians. And now, you know, on this question of Ben-Gurion, which is a very interesting question, Ben-Gurion kept talking about the Lausanne Treaty. Why was he talking about the Lausanne Treaty? Most people don't remember that, from 1923, because in Lausanne, because of the horrific war between Greece and Turkey, in 1923, there was a decision to unmix the populations, to remove Greeks who were living in Turkey to Greece, although they had lived in so-called Turkey long before there was a Turkey, since antiquity, and to move Turks from Greece to Turkey, although they were not actually Turks, they were Muslims, but they were called Turks, so as to stop to diffuse this cause of violence between them. That was internationally agreed transfer of population, which was very brutal. It included 1.5 million people. For people like Ben-Gurion, this appeared like a pretty good idea. That is, the Jews would be on one side and the Palestinians would be on the other side. What the line would be, where one side would be here and the other side there, well, that was negotiable for him, right? If we could have more, we'll take more. If we can't, like in the partition resolution, which would have been a very small state, at that point, it was agreeable to that too. So he was a pragmatist within a very dogmatic ideological stance that there must be a Jewish majority state. So what I'm saying is that those people, yes, they were nationalists, they were ethno-nationalists, they were pragmatists, they were realistic, and they had brutal thinking. But it does not mean that they were not open to the idea that Israel would have to find a way to coexist with the populations around it, including, of course, with the Palestinians. The question was how, and that how changes over time. But it's not what we see now was not written on the wall in 1929 or 1921 or 1936.
Just in terms of that counterfactual, because you argue then, you know, the two states were mandated by partition, by the UN partition plan. And with hindsight, we can look back and go, well, actually, would it not have been better, given the fate of the Palestinian people, to accept that situation? I mean, just on that, realistically, do I think any people in that situation would have accepted that? Are people who 30 years earlier represented 5% of the population getting over half the land? I think that's, and now constitute a third of that population and then get half the land, over half the land. That seems, I don't think a single people on earth would have accepted that. But I guess the counterfactual that I'm interested in, and you mentioned it briefly there, is the territory allocated to the Jewish state had 498,000 or so Jews within it, 407,000 Arabs, and then plus 90,000 Arab Bedouins in particular. So right. As you say, it's about half. So a proposed Jewish state was initially almost exactly half Arab. Now, that was not, it's not plausible that the aims of Zionism could have been achieved in that situation, unless you either have unrestricted Jewish, well, one or many of these things, basically, unrestricted Jewish immigration controlled by a Jewish government, ethnically, politically, Jewish government, much narrower borders, restricting Palestinian citizenship, the right of refugee return, or inducing or coercing Palestinians to leave. In that counterfactual, that state, if it was made to be a Jewish state, even though half the population were not Jewish, how could it possibly have ended in any other situation than the scenarios that I've outlined?
Look, I mean, we can't tell. The only thing that I'm saying is that there would have been an Arab state as well. There would have been a Palestinian state. Jews learned in the 1920s and 30s, and certainly in the 1940s, and what Palestinians learned, of course, and are suffering from right now, is that if you don't have a state, you don't have a seat in the international community. In any state, even a very weak state, is better than no state at all. Being stateless is a particularly horrific condition to be in a world in which everybody lives in states. You just have to imagine not having a passport. You just can't move around. So in that sense, had there been an Arab state and a Jewish state, those questions that you raise would have looked very differently from how they looked in 1948 when Israel carried out ethnic cleansing of Palestinians from what became the state of Israel, which became much larger than the state that was allotted to the Jews in the partition resolution. Because there was no Palestinian state, and the international community didn't really talk about Palestinians as anything but refugees that somehow one needs to maybe support them a bit, have some agency that would take care of them, but did not speak of them as nationals, as members of a state, because they didn't have one. And the Jews did. So all I'm saying again is I don't know how that would have worked out, and I don't know that anybody can say. But when you have a state, it gives you much more weight within the international community, and it gives the members of that state a whole set of rights that they do not have if they don't have a state. So again, it makes sense that the Palestinian leadership rejected the partition resolution. We just have to remember now that when people speak about a two-state solution, hypothetically, of course, that two-state solution is about 22% of the land. That's what is being spoken about now, not something like 48%. That's the tragedy of it.
You argue Zionism could have essentially said its historic mission was accomplished once Israel was established as a refuge for Jews and then given way to constitutional citizenship. And I guess, again, not this, we're talking of counter, this is all counterfactuals, obviously, but how was that ever plausible? Was it a retrospective solution that no successful nationalist movement has ever voluntarily embraced? And, you know, you talk about the tragedy, basically, that a constitution was never set, was never devised. The Declaration of Independence did talk about equal rights for all. Some might argue that was just a PR exercise because Resolution 181, passed by the United Nations, required each proposed state to adopt a democratic constitution, prohibit discrimination, guarantee equal protection, grant resident citizenship with full civil and political rights, prevent discriminatory land expropriation. So it was a kind of like, look, that was a document where you say that you're going to do that, and then Israel didn't do that. And obviously avoiding a constitution was kind of canny move in that situation. So what do you think? Do you think that was ever plausible? And are we just basically arguing against, forget Zionism for a minute, it's just any nationalist movement of this sort just goes against its nature?
Possibly yes, but there were actually debates over that. This was not that people say, okay, let's just issue this, what in Israel is called the Declaration of Independence. That's not the official name of the document. It's the proclamation of the state. Let's issue this proclamation and say, as the proclamation says, that within a few months there will be a constitution, and then not have it and forget it. There were discussions over that. And there were people within the leadership of the pre-state Jewish community who thought that a constitution was very important, who also insisted that the state had to define its borders, which Israel hasn't to this day. And they thought that because they actually believed in creating a state of laws. A Rechtsstaat, as the Germans call it, you know, a state that is based on the rule of law. So, first of all, the question is, was it realistic that there would be a constitution? One has to remember that although Israel did not adopt a constitution, it created the mechanism for the creation of a constitution. And constitutional laws were passed over several, many years, some of them problematic and some of them that were actually geared to create the basis for a constitution. So constitutional or work toward a constitution actually is built into the Israeli system. The problem is, of course, that in 2018, one of the basic laws, these are the sort of pre-constitution laws that was passed, was the basic law on Israel is the nation state of the Jews, which is a discriminatory law. So it creates the basis for a discriminatory constitution. You should also remember that today, following October 7th and following the so-called legal or judicial overhaul in Israel, many politicians in Israel are speaking about the need to adopt a constitution. They're aware of the fact that without a constitution, Israel has no, the entire political system is extremely fragile. And when a country engages in genocide, as Israel has, one effect of that, quite apart from killing large numbers of people, is that its own system frays, its own political system frays. And Israel is on the brink of losing whatever remains of Israeli democracy for its own Jewish population and, of course, its Palestinian citizens. So, no, I don't think it was just a pie in the sky and only a lie. The second thing is, what would have happened had Israel adopted the constitution? And there again, I mean, of course, we're speculating, but if you look at decisions that were being made in Israel immediately after the war of 1948, had there been a constitution with a Bill of Rights, many of those decisions would have been very difficult. the decision, the fact that the Supreme Court supported the imposition of military rule over the Palestinians who remained in what became the state of Israel and became citizens for 20 years would have been very difficult legally had there been a constitution. I think that a constitution might have also made it more likely that the kind of debates that existed in Israel immediately after the war regarding repatriation and compensation for Palestinians who were ethnically cleansed, it would have been easier to appeal to a constitution to try and work toward that. And ironically, had Israel done that, the main problem of Israeli existence, which is relations between Palestinians and Jews, and is at the core of which is the ethnic cleansing of 1948, might have been addressed much better than it has. So, and finally, of course, the fact that Israel has always had a theocratic aspect to it, which now is on steroids. It's becoming a more and more Jewish, religiously Jewish state, and a kind of Judaism that is unrecognizable by anybody who, like people like my grandparents, it's a completely different kind of Jewish supremacist Judaism. A constitution would have made it much more difficult to pass the kind of laws that are being contemplated in Israel today. So I think it would have made a difference. Of course, you can throw constitutions, you know, to the garbage, or you can change them. But constitutions have a certain limiting aspect to them. They define a state in a particular way. And that was not done partly for pragmatic reasons, partly because, as you say, for the leaders of the state at the time, that would have meant that they had to create a state with equal rights for Jews and Palestinians. And they did not want to do that.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose that's what people would argue. They'd say, you know, why would the same political leadership, which is expelling Palestinians, simultaneously draw up a constitution that enshrined equal rights? I mean, the same political leadership expelling Palestinians would draw that constitution up. So I guess people would ask, why would that constitution have restrained Jewish supremacy in that land rather than enshrined it? You know, is the missing constitution really the cause of the problem, or evidence its founders couldn't reconcile constitutional equality with the Jewish majority that they were creating by force at the time?
Yeah, look, I mean, that's the core of the question. The core of the question is whether you can have a Jewish and democratic state. And as we've discovered, you can't. You can have a Jewish and democratic state only if the vast majority, if not all, of the population are Jews. And then, you know, they can have whatever they like among themselves. But as long as you have a Palestinian minority, and you actually make the majority into a minority, then you can't. And a constitution would have made that clear. So, but I want to say, look, I mean, what I argue in the book is that the state made a particular decision at the moment of its foundation. I don't think that decision was inevitable. Oh, I lost you for a minute. Okay.
Yeah, I'm here.
Yeah. I don't think that decision was inevitable, but I do think that had a decision been made to have a constitution, we would have been looking at a very different scenario. The decision made not to have a constitution transformed Zionism. It made it into a state ideology. And those dynamics of Zionism, they were always there, but were not the exclusive dynamics, which were of militarism, of expansionism, of ethnic cleansing, became the leitmotif, became the leading vector of what the state was about. And again, even then, it was not inevitable. In the 1990s, there was an effort to change that. In the post-1967, there was a moment at which Israel could have, and there were voices in Israel that spoke about it, could have reached an agreement both with Palestinians and with the rest of the Arab states and didn't use that opportunity. So there were moments, even after that, that the state could have changed its own nature. And I think, hypothetically, it's still possible. In fact, I think that the state of Israel today, if it doesn't reinvent itself, is going to become an entity that would be both the pariah state in the world and will not have long-term prospects of survival. But that decision in 1948, about which people spoke, it wasn't just the sort of, you know, it's not just me speculating about it, was the wrong decision. And I think it's important to identify that if you are trying to think whether things could have gone differently.
One of the most disturbing arguments in the book is about how Holocaust memory becomes not a warning against dehumanizing people, but a license for Israel to use almost unlimited violence. And, you know, I often think about the parallels with Serb nationalism, because what Serb nationalism does is fuse victimhood with chauvinism. And the Serbs were victims of genocide in World War II. And if we look at the Balkan Wars of the 1990s, the Serb nationalists would send at the very center what they suffered, the genocide they suffered at the hand of the Nazis. They would portray the Bosniaks and the Croats as those who committed the genocide and collaborated with the Nazis. And the Ustashi at the time, for those who don't know the Croat Ustashi, were, you know, the Nazis thought they were sadistic, frankly, in terms of some of the methods that they were employing. What I'm interested there in, because what the Serb nationalists would do when they justified ethnic cleansing, they go, we used to be a majority there, but then genocide was committed against us, so we're reclaiming our rightful lands, which were stolen from us by genocide. And they would also, at the same time, point to the atrocities being committed against Serb civilians. 7,000 Serb civilians were killed in Bosnia. And they would use that as a trigger point to what they suffered in World War II, the genocide they suffered. I went to Belgrade in 2 years ago. It was just after Srebrenica had been, it was a vote on Srebrenica being a genocide at the UN. And at the tallest building in Belgrade, there's a neon sign rotating, "We are not a genocidal people." The view of the Serbs is we are the victims of genocide and therefore we could never commit genocide. It's actually outrageous, and you're actually intentionally trying to trigger our trauma by even suggesting we would commit genocide. I'm just interested in that parallel. It's not the you know, there was the genocide that the Serbs suffered was not the same as genocide take different forms. That's one, I think, very important part of this story, by the way, because the Holocaust, the industrialized systematic murder of 6 million Jews in a very short space of time is an outlier, really, in how genocides take place. And that often leads people to not understand how genocides can take different forms. But I'm just interested in that part because, I mean, do you think that's part of the issue? It's because you do actually get there's quite a similar phenomenon there. Like, how dare you're accusing us of committing genocide in order to basically relitigate the trauma we suffered. We could never commit genocide. We're the victims of genocide. But that almost makes a genocidal mentality more likely because you, if you only view yourself as the victim of a genocide and therefore never the perpetrator, you almost see that's actually just impossible. That makes it, you see yourself as, I always have to protect myself and my people from the threat of genocide. We are the victims of genocide and no one else really in this context. What do you think of that? Sorry, that was a long question, but I think about this a lot in terms of Serb nationalism and those parallels and how that, the form it takes. I think the difference is Israel has impunity and Serb nationalism doesn't have impunity.
Yeah, you know, there's a Serb movie from years ago called Underground by Kusturica, who's a fantastic Serb filmmaker. And it describes the situation that you're talking about, that there are Serb partisans who were fighting the Nazis, and they are building a tank. And they're underground, they're building the tank, and they keep building the tank into the 1990s. And the 1990s, they come out, and they're still fighting that war that they were fighting against the Nazis. So it's a sort of, the story is the story of your sense of victimhood, as you say, that justifies the kind of violence that you carry against other people. Now, of course, the Nazis are not ruling the former Yugoslavia in the 1990s. The Nazis are gone. And the Nazis are gone also. There's no Nazis in Gaza. Despite what Israel says, that Hamas are the Nazis, and that the massacre of October 7th was the largest killing of Jews since the Holocaust. So you are imagining a particular enemy that is long gone. So in that sense, yes, of course, look, I mean, I wrote about this, I don't know, 30 years ago, I wrote an article on the empowering of victimhood, the sense of victimhood tends to give you license, a sense of license. You have to remember that the Nazis themselves saw themselves as victims, not as perpetrators. They were victims of the stab in the back of 1918 when the German Empire collapsed and they were stabbed in the back by the Bolsheviks and the Jews. And therefore, they had to rebuild Germany to make Germany great again. And the main enemy, the enemy within and the enemy without, were the Bolsheviks and the Jews. And so when they were killing Jews, they were just wreaking revenge on what they believed the Jews had done to them. So in that sense, yes, this sort of, and it's not surprising that during the wars in the former Yugoslavia, one country that remained very supportive of the Serbs was Israel. Because there is a sense in Israel that the Serbs are like us. And I was in Serbia in the early 1980s, and Serbs were, so it was a bit strange because I was being hosted there and people were telling me anti-Semitic jokes. And I said, you know, I don't like anti-Semitic jokes. I take them only from Jews. And they said, but you're from Israel. And I said, yeah, you know, but Israel is a country with a Jewish majority. He said, yeah, but you guys are different because you know how to deal with Arabs, with Muslims. So these were liberal Serbs in whose mind their main enemy was Kosovo. And that was in the early 1980s before all the killing began. So you have these kind of tropes. The difference, of course, and that takes you back to Zionism, all of this is true. But it takes you back to another thing, which is that Zionism had a particular idea that it was to, that its goal was to normalize Jewish existence. It was to create a new Jewish man. This is also within the kind of Soviet speak of a new Soviet man. So a new Jewish man. What did it mean? The Jews were these little people who were living in all kind of shtetlach around Europe, were being mistreated. Were not a martial people, were not a people who could defend themselves, were people who would let their wives and sisters and mothers be raped by Cossacks and so forth. And so the Jews had to remake themselves. That also, by the way, refers to what you said before, the conquest of labor. Conquest of labor was not about taking labor from Arabs. This was not the way they thought about it. That was the result of it. The idea was to make Jews into farmers, to make Jews into people who work the land, who root themselves in the land and are not engaged in Luftgeschäft, in sort of air business. So apart from the trauma of the Holocaust, which is used and has become a tool in Israeli politics, there's also this notion that we can never become like those Jews who went like sheep to the slaughter. And Serbs didn't have that idea about themselves as going like sheep to the slaughter. They fought like lions in World War II. They had the highest casualty count per capita of all the countries, including the Soviet Union. But the Jews and Zionism created this notion of the Jews never again being like those sheep who went to the slaughter. That, together with the notion of victimhood, provides you with a particularly explosive will for destruction. If you add to that the fact that on October 7th, those people that Israelis had become used to think of people that they can boss around and had bossed around for six decades, suddenly attack them, killed hundreds of civilians, but also hundreds of soldiers, and took over parts of the country. So that also triggered this other kind of colonial response when the natives rise up against you. So if you put all of that together, you get this sense of self-righteousness, which is crucial to, I think, it's hard to find a genocide in the modern era in which those who are carrying out the killing are not also thinking about themselves as doing the righteous thing. And here, this righteous notion that Israelis have right now about the horrors that they perpetrated in Gaza, which they both know and deny at the same time, is also fueled by this notion that we may never be pushed back into the shtetl again.
I mean, that mentality, I'm really interested in it because I think about it a lot. And, you know, I look at the polling in Israel and it is so disturbing when you get, if I can get the exact poll amongst Jews, I think it was 2/3 say there are no innocents in Gaza. And you look at that and think, well, I mean that includes kids, obviously, that includes children. And you see discussions on Israeli television where they openly talk about children as being future terrorists. And that's disturbing because, and I always generally have tried to just not make these comparisons, but the Nazis did say that about Jewish children. They did say, they did make that argument. I guess I'm just trying to just understand, because there's been this great divergence. It's quite, I think someone at some point will write a book about it, the great divergence between Jewish Americans and Jewish Israelis, where there's, you know, a similar size population. One is becoming more and more progressive and the other is just veering off into increasingly genocidal mentalities. What's your just, how do we just can I, because you talk about people you care about, you know, people you love who don't have any sense of emotion about Palestinian suffering. And these are people, of course, who you know, would, you know, cry at sad films, who would help an old woman across the road, who would grieve when watching a film in which someone who's a fictional character gets killed. And Palestinian kids are being slaughtered en masse. Because you grew up there. How do you explain that? How do you understand that?
Yeah, and people who love their pets too. Look, first of all, what you said about the difference between Israeli Jews and American Jews, I have to say I've received a fair amount of mail from American Jews reflecting similar sentiments, such arguments such as, well, had Israel really wanted to carry out genocide, it could have killed them all on the first day, right? So this is not enough. 73,000 at the minimum, that's not enough. 21,000 children, that's not enough for it to be genocide. That's, you know. So these sentiments have been, unfortunately, also spread outside of Israel. But as for Israel itself, look, I mean, the way I try to talk about it in the book, I think there are two strands. One strand is what we talked about, and that's the way the Holocaust has been clearly weaponized by Israeli regimes, by Israeli education, by the Israeli media to justify the unjustifiable. Because, and there's a huge irony here, because the Holocaust starts playing this role of an imminent danger just at the same time that Israel becomes the military hegemon in the area. The last war that Israel fought, that was a war against armies, was the war that I was in 1973. And since then, it's been fighting militias that are in large part its own creation. And these are groups that cannot, even if they wanted to, cannot present an existential danger to Israel, which has a very large and powerful army. And it's at that point that the Holocaust starts playing a role, where if some Hamas militant fires a rocket, then that's an existential threat, and therefore we have to think of them as as perpetrating future Auschwitz against us. So it justifies the occupation. And the second aspect of it is the occupation itself. That is that what has happened in Israel since 1967, over time, is that Palestinians started increasingly being dehumanized by Israelis. So Israelis can actually go to an Arab country, say to the Gulf States or to Jordan or to Egypt, and they go there as tourists, or they can go to other parts of the world. But the Palestinians specifically are really seen by most Israelis as untermenschen, as subhuman, as people who don't have rights to have rights, who should be kept under the boot. That kind of process, we have generations of young Israeli men and women who go to the army, and what they do in the army is they break into people's homes, they mistreat children and old people, they stop ambulances in checkpoints and let pregnant women just not be able to go to the hospital, lose their children or lose their own life. That kind of dehumanization of others obviously dehumanizes you too. And that has become an inherent part of racism in Israel. And in that sense, if you think, as you said before, if you add to that the fundamental idea in Israel, you cannot say genocide, because if you say genocide, the only thing that comes to mind is the Holocaust. And we cannot be doing the Holocaust to others. The Holocaust is what they did to us. If you combine that with the decades-long brutal occupation of Palestinians, and you add the moment of October 7th, then large numbers of people in Israel either support the destruction of Gaza, they literally want to see people killed, and maybe that's a quarter or a third of the population, and people that you ask me about, the people that I know, generally don't want to talk about it. They just want to change the subject. They want to think about their own pain, about their own suffering, about their own fears. And they also, unfortunately, and that's the parallel that you can draw with the case of the Germans, you know, I started my career studying the crimes of the Wehrmacht, and I was studying that in the 1980s. And at the time, Germans still refused to accept that the German army was involved in crimes. Yes, we did terrible crimes, but it was the SS and the Gestapo, not the army, because the army were our fathers and our grandfathers and our uncles and our brothers. They could not have done that. Think about Israel today. So many of the people that I know have children who serve in the army. Can they think of their children as being genocide? They cannot do that. And this is generational too. You know, it was them, it was their children, it was their fathers, it was often their grandfathers. They all served in the military. To think of the military, which is, of course, a very different animal today from what it was when I served in it for various reasons, to think of their children as participating in genocide, not even war crimes, it's unthinkable. And so there's so many layers to this denial that the only way that Israel will ever recover from it, and it will have to recover from it if it ever wants to become a healthy society again, how do you face up to it? It will only be when it doesn't have a choice. And it won't have a choice when it's presented with major pressure from the outside to face up to what it has done.
Before I ask you about that, about what next, basically, in terms of what possible hope there is. I mean, you present this book, obviously, as an account of the moral and political collapse of Israel, its degeneration, notwithstanding, of course, you spoke about the crimes in which it was founded and so on, but that degeneration, nonetheless, from where it was. But, of course, this was a genocide facilitated from the beginning by the West, by Western weapons, by Western diplomatic protection, by Western media, the industry in which I work, which whitewashed crimes, legitimized crimes, cheered on crimes. Where does this leave the West? I mean, the moral collapse of the West. And, you know, I thought when last year, Donald Trump said a civilization has been wiped out in Gaza or destroyed. I can't remember what he said. And I thought of that again when he said about Iran. He threatened Iran with genocide. He said a civilization will die tonight, never to recover. And I thought to myself, he's thinking of Gaza in his head, isn't he? He's got the images of apocalyptic rubble of Gaza in his head because he used the same term about civilization being destroyed in Gaza. And you think of contagion. You think of what is legitimized. And for me, that was always not just what was happening to the Palestinians. It's what about the future of humanity? Mm-hmm. If you legitimize this, a live stream genocide, where actually it's very clear what Israeli leaders were saying from the beginning they were going to do, and which they did. And the best roadmap to understand what Israel did to the Palestinians is just listen to what they were saying in the first few days, because they executed it to the letter. You know, one Israeli official said, every building will be, there'll be a city of tents. They did that. They said, you know, they spoke of human animals. They, you know, yep. Where does this leave us as a species, this experience?
So I think you know that a few days ago, I published another op-ed in the New York Times, and I actually talked about that, or tried to talk about the future of genocide. What does Gaza teach us about the future of genocide? So, yes, first of all, Israel's allies, Western democracies and the United States not only provided Israel with impunity to keep carrying out this genocide, but supported it economically, militarily, and politically, gave it cover. And these are the same countries that claim to be the main supporters of human rights and international law. And they facilitated that. And in that sense, what happened in Gaza is actually quite unique. There were many genocides after 1945. At least since the fall of the Soviet Union, attempts were made at least to bring some people to account. We talked about Yugoslavia, the same with Rwanda and Cambodia. There were attempts. And these attempts, although they were not that successful, they did at least make it impossible to deny that those things had happened. And that was the whole idea after 1945. This is the idea of the Genocide Convention, that you have to try to prevent it and you have to punish those who carry it out. And here, this is the first time that the genocide was facilitated by countries that claim to be the protectors of human rights and international law. But what is the future of that? So first of all, we see that this happened, and we don't see yet any accountability. But second, it is quite possible that everybody is going to profit from this genocide. And that was the case in the past. Genocide is not just done because you're bloody-minded. Genocide is done because you can profit from it. That's what happened with the Ottoman Empire and the Turks. You know, vast properties were taken over. This is what the Germans did in German Southwest Africa, now Namibia, in 1904 and so forth. You can profit from it. And now it appears that this is back, because the kind of talk we have about Gaza seems to indicate that possibly it will become a bonanza of real estate, that Americans will use Gaza, that doesn't belong to them, as an area for investment. Arab countries will provide money to build all these glitzy towers. The rich and famous of Europe and the United States will come to inhabit them, and the Palestinians who are there will be kept in so-called humanitarian cities, basically camps, and they will be allowed to go out to build those towers and then to serve them, to clean dishes, clean toilets for those rich Europeans and Americans who would come. And Israel, which controls now close to 70%, it's been moving the yellow line consistently further into Gaza. We use that territory, of course, to implant more settlements, and to show how it can green that area that it entirely devastated. That's a very scary prospect. How do we prevent it? Well, look, I mean, there was a protest movement in late 2023, in the spring of 2024, much of it died down. The public has moved on. And those people, politicians, academics, intellectuals, the media, they have other concerns. This has to be kept in mind because the price for that will not just be what happens in Gaza. It'll be for all those other people who are planning genocide into the future, thinking the genocide, as I wrote in this piece, could be the continuation of policy by other means. You can conquer and profit by killing large numbers of people. Now, the one caveat I would put is that I think that Israel has gone so crazy, and its political leaders have spoken in such terms that it has, in fact, turned public opinion in those very same countries against it. And its position now within public opinion may, in the future, be reflected also in incoming political leadership. And I think it's not unlikely that a future American president, whether Republican or Democrat, will change his or her policy vis-a-vis Israel, which would be good for everyone, including for Israel itself. But that's 3-some years down the road. And meanwhile, the killing goes on and the general indifference continues. And I just have to say that the media, the European and American media, has been so derelict, has been so criminally derelict in reporting from Gaza and insisting Israel has closed Gaza off for the media, as if that's a natural thing to do. And you see no pressure on these governments pressuring Israel to allow media to report, which would actually continue to shift public opinion if people could actually see what is going on there.
I agree. Although public opinion has dramatically shifted, of course, in the West, and we can see that in the polling, you know, in America, yeah. Where a massive lead of Americans think Israel has committed genocide and support the arrested Benjamin Netanyahu, as an example. These are presented as fringe opinions. Just a couple of final things. I mean, on that, in terms of, you know, I've interviewed Gideon Levy, the Israeli columnist, several times, and he thinks this ends with Western public opinion being interpreted into state policy. And that's how this ends. Just in terms of, you argue for a binational state, and look on this, you know, and there's a long history of Brits getting out maps and drawing on them. So I'm not going to, you know, just, it's not my place to do that. Though, you know, my starting point is from the river to the sea, every citizen should have equal rights irrespective of their nationality, religion, ethnicity, and so on. And that should always be the starting point and of whatever is the end point. I guess when you talk about a binational state, I guess it's easy to just look at this and think every possible outcome is impossible and utopian, to be honest. And I guess one point I would make, this is just one example, is not just the total radicalization we're talking about amongst the Jewish Israeli population. 9 months into the genocide, the former chief of MI6, Sir John Sowers, recounted an Israeli official told him that 6 in 10 Hamas fighters are orphans from previous conflicts. Now, the reason I say that is the people of Israel know more than enough, I would argue, about what has been done to Gaza. They know it's been wiped out from the face of the earth. They know a huge number of people have been killed. They know terrible crimes have been committed. They might, if you ask them and push them, they might push back and get defensive and all the rest of it. People know more than enough. You know, this isn't like all the, you can just, you know, I know the polling shows that, you know, people in Israel think Fox News is too sympathetic towards the plight of Palestinians and also mainstream Israeli channels. People know more than enough. And I guess one obvious obstacle is people think to themselves, well, they will come for us. We've committed abominable crimes, and there was absolutely no way. Now there's things have too far, and now we have to just finish the job and remove the entire population of Gaza. There's no coexistence to be had. Do you see what I mean? What do you think about that? There's just that sense of they know, you know, how can they ever be compelled now, knowing what has been done, to believe that there is some sort of coexistence, both because of their radicalization and their dehumanization, and also because of the knowledge of the crimes that have been committed and what that could possibly mean?
Yeah, so look, first of all, I don't talk about a binational state. I talk about a confederation.
Oh, sorry, confederation. So, sorry, yeah, I do apologize. So you said confederation. It's not the same.
Yeah, that's a different animal. Whether it's possible right now or not, of course, no, it's not possible right now.
Describe a confederation. Sorry, I should have said a confederation. Describe what a confederation is.
So this idea of a confederation, which is not my idea, I'm adopting an idea that... from a group called Land for All that I've been associated with, but I didn't come up with this idea.
Like my Ozinon, for example, he's been pushing it. He's one of the, his relatives were killed in October 7th and he's been a peace activist. He's pushed it.
Yes, correct. Yeah. And you know, like Meron Rapoport, who is also a journalist and a friend of mine. The basic idea of this particular confederation is a recognition that the two-state solution is dead because of the settlement project, because there are, you know, 250,000 Jews living in the West Bank and East Jerusalem, and they can't be removed from there. And a recognition that both groups, Jews and Palestinians, have deep links to the place, and that both groups have two... fundamental desires. One is self-determination, national self-determination, and the other is the right of return. Israel has both, of course, and Palestinians have neither. Within this constraints and these requirements, what this confederation is trying to envision is the creation of two states that would be more or less along the 1967 lines, but that they would make a distinction between citizenship and residence, so that you could be a citizen of one state and reside in the other, and that the borders would be open so that people could move from one place to another. That means that if you are Palestinian, or trace yourself to Palestinian ancestry and say your family is from Haifa, but you live in London, you could go to Palestine. If Palestine had the kind of laws that Israel has today, you could become easily a Palestinian citizen, and then you could apply for residence in Haifa and live in Haifa as a Palestinian citizen. And if you're a settler, and you decide to remain in the state of Palestine, assuming that vast numbers of settlers would not want to live in the state of Palestine, you could, as an extraterritorial Israeli citizen, obviously you'd have to obey the law, and if you didn't, you would be expelled. You would be deported to your state of citizenship. Mm-hmm. That's the sort of model, okay? Now, is it possible now? No. Can it lead to what you were speaking about and what Avrum Burg has been speaking about, you know, to one state? Because there is only one state right now between the Jordan and the sea. It's the state of Israel, with people living under different types of regimes. But it's one state. All this thing, as if there's a Palestinian state. There isn't any, of course. Can it become that, a state of all its citizens? Yes, it could. But I think that right now... most Israeli Jews and most Palestinians would want, first of all, to be able to exercise self-determination and a right of return. And that's one way to facilitate that. So that's on this question. And, you know, people who listen to you can Google A Land for All and they can find all the documents on that. I think it is a very creative idea. Now, on that other question, yes, of course, that's part of genocide. That's part of the dynamic of genocide, is that after what we have done to them, we know what they will do to us, and therefore we have to wipe them out. So it justifies killing, because you have to finish them to the end. That's what he said about children, you know. We have to kill their children because when they grow up, they will be Hamasniks, of course, right? Because we know what we did to them. But that logic is a kind of logic that only fuels the extremists. You can break this logic. You could have, this logic existed in 1945 in Europe. Why would anybody have wanted to have any relations with the Germans after what they did? People living in Coventry, people living in London, people living in Poland. Why would anybody have wanted to have anything to do with the Germans? But people changed their minds over time. And when they changed their minds, when they were given the prospect of a better future, it's not that, you know, there was no vengeance in people's hearts. Of course there was. But they also wanted a better future, and they knew what the alternative looked like. And so I think that if you begin to help people, and that's why this confederation idea, I think, has to be kept alive. If you can tell people things could look different, some people will never accept it, and you have to marginalize them, of course. But the majority may well accept it. But in order to get there, in order to start the process right now, there has to be something akin to what Europe looked like in 1945. That is, it can't be like Germany at the end of 1918. It has to be 1945. That is, Israel has to be forced to change. And that can only happen through a regime of sanctions. Severe international economic, military, and political sanctions to put Israelis back in their place. Without that, I don't think that we are looking at anything but the ongoing killing and destruction.
Amen to that. And by the way, just finally, that's why I often noted the attitudes within the Jewish Israeli population, and people say, well, what is the point of this? You're just, this is not going to help. How are you going to get peace this way? And the point is the dangers of sowing illusions that change will happen from within when actually change has to be imposed from without. And that's just hard-headed pragmatism in this particular situation. I mean, honestly, absolutely fascinating. A really, really, really important a piece of literature, political literature, which people should read and engage with. And your moral courage throughout has been so important. And you reach people, you know, for example, in the New York Times, a newspaper which I would say has not covered itself in glory, like most of the Western media in which I operate, and that you reached audiences who needed to be reached. And I think lots of people have read your work and know that you speak from a position of academic and scholarly authority, that you've spoken about your own background as someone who grew up in a Zionist family, even a former IDF officer. You had a lot of emotional kind of struggle to get to the point at which you did. You didn't come to this conclusion easily, given that context, and you did so because of the facts and the evidence and what your scholarly work told you to do. So for those watching, please do share, press like, subscribe, leave your thoughts, leave your comments. But Omar, honestly, thanks so much. And please, people, again, do get Israel, What Went Wrong, and do engage full stop with the so, so important work that Omar publishes. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
And just like that, we arrive at the final breaths of this week's broadcast. The slow dimming of a lantern, the quiet settling of truth after an hour that asked much of the heart. As you step back into your day, may you carry with you the questions that refuse to be buried, the courage that refuses to fade, and the curiosity that keeps truth alive in a world that works tirelessly to silence it. I'm Arlene Russell, your host and narrator. Sharing this hour with you has been an honor, an hour grounded in clarity, in dignity, in a solidarity that does not evaporate when the headlines shift or when the cameras turn away. If something you heard today unsettled you, challenged you, or cracked open a door you didn't know existed, and if you ever feel the pull to lend your own voice to this work, know that this space will always have room for you.
You can reach us anytime at twippodcasts@gmail.com. To you, our listeners, thank you. Thank you for your time, your trust, your willingness to walk this difficult path beside us. Your presence is the quiet proof that truth still matters, that memory still matters, that resistance still matters. If you missed any part of today's program, you can find us on every major platform: YouTube, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, Podcast Index, iHeartRadio, Pocket Casts, Deezer, Overcast, Castro, Podchaser, Castbox, Player FM, Good Pods, and True Fans. You can also explore our full archive on radio4all.net and archive.org. Just search This Week in Palestine, or TWIP, and look for the image of the little girl raising her hands in the victory sign. We're also featured on Million Podcasts, a platform uplifting Arab American creators and helping listeners discover new voices. Thank you for being here. Thank you for listening. We'll return next week. Until then, take care, stay grounded, stay steadfast. This is This Week in Palestine. This is occupied land. This is Palestine. And the call for freedom continues. Free Palestine, from the river to the sea. Falastin Hara.